Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Today is Easter Sunday, April 16th, 2006, and this is show number 39. Well, for once it rained on a Friday instead of a Monday, so I actually got to have a clean car for most of the week. It was a happy week because of that. Well, yesterday I washed my daughter's car, then I clayed it, and then I waxed it. Of course, a good detail job isn't complete without tire blacking the tires, too. If you haven't ever heard of claying, it's really cool. They sell you a bar of soft clay and a spray bottle with a kind of spray wax in it. You spray the wax on the car and then rub it around with the clay, and the clay picks up all those little dots of road tar and gunk that you get from the Los Angeles air. I imagine if you live in Minnesota, you probably don't have that problem, but we got a lot of gunk in our air. You can see it. Anyway, it makes the surface of the car really smooth when you're done, even without waxing it. If you just wax in Los Angeles, it won't even feel like you did anything. It feels nasty. So, of course, I throw down a layer of Carnauba wax on top of that to protect it. I put a picture of the car in the show notes, proudly showing me showing off how good this 8-year-old Honda looks when I'm done. You can see my iPod Nano with the lanyard headphones there, too. I had some podcasts to catch up on anyway, and I get very productive when I'm listening to them. I have a definite pattern to which podcasts I listen to and when, so I thought I'd outline that for you here. Leo's KFI podcast is for driving in the car, so I burn those CDs along with Twit podcasts whenever they do one. I'm usually a month behind, but for some reason I'm stuck in January still on those. I can't seem to get out of January. I'm not sure what's going on. I keep listening. I listen to it all the time. Can't get out of it. I love listening to Leo, so I don't want to jump ahead and skip any just to be up to date. It's kind of dorky listening, though. For example, he's still talking about how nothing happened at CES and speculating on what will happen at Macworld Expo in January. It's kind of fun to listen to speculation when you know how wrong they're going to be. Adam Christensen's The MacCast is for jogging on Saturday mornings. It's a great way to get my weekly Mac fix, and the time just flies by when I'm listening to him. It was a big bummer yesterday when I discovered that his cast got truncated. It was only a minute 13 long. I have to delete the feed and re-add it to get it right. That's a low-impact operation, so no worries. Tim Verporten's Mac Review Cast is perfect for car washing, followed by Steve Stanger's Mac Attack podcast for tire blacking and maybe a little wax here and there. If I'm still feeling industrious, I'll crank up Steve Stanger's The Mac Attack podcast. I did all of those yesterday, that's for sure, when I was waxing. So by the time I've had a shower on Saturday morning, I've run 4 miles, washed my car, cleaned up, and learned a ton about new Mac utilities. I love it because I'm learning while I'm enjoying myself and being productive. I use my iPod Nano on my lanyard headphones so I can just tuck the Nano into my shirt and it doesn't get wet with all the car washing and stuff. I'm curious, how do you listen to podcasts? Do you listen to them at the computer or on CDs or on an MP3 player? And what do you do while you listen? I'm really curious to understand how other people enjoy this medium. Drop me an email at allison@podfeet.com and give me your perspective. Speaking of great podcasts, I mentioned Tim Verporten's Mac Review Cast a moment ago, and I have a promo from Tim that I'd like to play for you. Tim is coming up on his one-year anniversary. Instead of expecting us to buy him birthday presents, he's going to give out prizes to us. He's got a great lineup of prizes, so take a listen and learn how to get involved in his show.
Hello, I'm Tim from the Mac Review Cast. I'm here to let you know that the Mac Review Cast will be celebrating its one-year anniversary on April 30th. Now, we have a special giveaway planned on the podcast with lots of prizes that'll make any tech fan happy. So please join us by visiting our website, www.macreviewcast.com, and listening to the podcast. We review hardware, software, and websites that make using the Mac special. Now, this weekend's podcast will tell you how to enter your name into the drawing and exactly what you can win. So make sure you listen and enter before the end of April to have a chance at all the great prizes. Now, the Mac Review Cast is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network, just like the one you're listening to now. Thank you, and I hope you're a winner in our one-year anniversary giveaway.
Well, so my kids are getting pretty big now, but we had a great time with an Easter egg hunt yesterday. For those of you who may be unfamiliar with this odd tradition, this is where parents hide either hard-boiled eggs that have been dyed different colors, or more commonly, plastic eggs filled with candy. Since my son and his friends are in high school, they told us to make the hunt really hard. Well, my daughter and I did a great job of this. We sent them upstairs and we told them that the eggs could be anywhere in the front yard, backyard, or downstairs. We put hardly any outside because they're way too easy to see. You know, bright purple against grass and trees, pretty obvious, and they're not that dumb. Inside was a different story. We put them inside the sugar bowl in the china cabinet, inside the garlic container, inside a zipped-up bag that was inside a cabinet, even one inside the mantel clock. But the real fun was when we realized that the garage was technically downstairs. This was a treasure trove of great places to hide eggs. Imagine I have a bike hanging from the ceiling that has a small bike bag on the back. Great place for an egg. 35 pairs of old soccer and baseball cleats on top of the fridge. Don't ask me why, but one of them had an egg in it. Yeah, they had to go all through those nasty things to find it. But one of my favorites was we put one in my beach chair. It has one of those pockets for a drink for when you're sitting down at the beach. At least four of the kids touched this chair, moved the chair, even squeezed the little pocket and still didn't notice the egg. It was hilarious. By far the funniest one was when one of the girls noticed an egg way under the couch. She squealed with delight that she'd found one. But then as she tried to reach under to get it, she got mobbed by the other kids trying to beat her to it. This went on for a good couple of minutes. They were jumping on each other, laughing, smacking each other. One kid kicked his brother for no apparent reason. But anyway, finally she got it and she pulls it out and it wasn't an egg at all. It was a rubber ball. My daughter and I were just cracking up when that happened. Hey, it's about time I get down to the business of the show, isn't it? Quit the fooling around. We didn't have any new countries for a while, but we got four new ones this week. I want to give a big welcome to our new listeners from Albania, Cambodia, Oman, and Papua New Guinea. And of course, welcome back to our long-term listeners. If you're new to the show, make sure you check out the show notes over at podfeet.com. I put in all the links for everything I talk about there, so you don't have to drive your car into a ditch trying to write them down. So remember my long diatribe about Samsung? Go back to show number 14 if you missed it. Oh, and I think I mentioned on show number 15 and 18, 31, 32, 33, and 34. So anyway, I never would have known that Samsung was the worst customer service of any company on earth if I had just bought the monitor through Costco.com. I'm telling you, I am a convert. I will shop at Costco.com as often as I can. I've always loved Costco. For those of you without one, it's one of those big warehouse stores. But one of the things I've noticed about them is that the way they rotate products in and out, it's actually easier to buy something you might want and return it than it is to come back later and get it when you're sure you want it and then they don't have it anymore. Of course, there's the great deals too. Anyway, this week I figured out how great Costco really is. I bought my daughter a Canon PowerShot camera a while ago from Costco.com. And out of the blue, this is like 5 months later, it starts showing the letters E18 on the display and won't open up the lens. I love how my daughter's a closet geek. She would totally deny she's a geek. But she jumped right in onto the internet and figured out that error 18, E18 means that the lens was sticking and wouldn't open. This happened on a Saturday, so I tried checking out Canon's website to see what their return policy, what their warranty was, and that kind of thing. But get this, Canon USA wasn't up on the weekend. I don't know what was going on, but what a bummer. So then I thought, well, let me check the Costco site and see what the return policy is, or maybe I could find a customer service number. Well, I found the number, so I called him up, and this wonderful man told me that all we had to do was drive over to any retail Costco, and they'd either give us our money back or give us a comparable camera. I didn't believe him. That can't be true. This camera was 5 months old. We didn't have an extended service warranty or anything. Well, my daughter took it back to Costco with the included CDs in the receipt, and drumroll here, they gave her her money back. They didn't have the comparable camera in stock, so they just gave her cash. But you can be sure I went right back to Costco.com to buy the replacement. The next bottle up had come out since then, and it only cost me an extra $20 to get her a higher level camera, and I had it shipped directly to her. I will try to direct as much of my purchasing as I can to Costco when I'm shopping online in the future. I am astounded by this level of service. You just can't get any better than this. It was really cool. Have you ever seen these commercials for the Honda Element? The one that shows the car talking to a crab or a platypus or some other silly animal? Well, my husband, for some reason, thinks these are hysterical, especially the one with the crab. The crab keeps trying to pinch the Element, but the Element doesn't think being pinched is such a good idea. If you haven't seen these ads, check them out at automobiles.honda.com/element. It might give you a giggle. Anyway, the reason I'm bringing it up is because of a sign we saw when we were driving. There's a picture of the element talking to the crab, and in the corner it said, if you want to listen to this commercial, go to AM 1680 on your radio right now. Well, that sounded kind of weird. What are they talking about? So, of course, we did it. And sure enough, they're actually broadcasting, evidently from somewhere near the sign, on 1680 of the commercial of the crab and then of the platypus and then of the crab again, over and over and over for weeks now. Isn't that the weirdest marketing idea you've ever heard of? I wonder how many people have actually tuned in to see just what they're doing. I bet we're the only ones. But hey, they're making us laugh. And of course, we make everybody we get in our car listen to them too. I want to clear up a misunderstanding about Apple mice. I've talked to a lot of Windows users lately who are considering Macintoshes, but they say that they don't see how we can live without a two-button scroll mouse. I need to set this record straight here. I don't know any Mac people who actually use the one-button mouse Apple ships with their computers. Even now that they ship them with the Mighty Mouse, which sort of gives you two-button functionality in a really uncomfortable way, no one actually uses these. All of us go out and buy nice or even cheap PC mice to work with our Macs, and then we have all the nice contextual menu items like you guys have. Even on a laptop, we use Control Click to get the right mouse click functionality. The Mighty Mouse is really more of a novelty mouse. I like what Patrick Norton referred to it in a review right after it came out. He called it a future collector's item. I think he was right on the money. I've played with mine, and it's kind of cute in a kind of annoying kind of way, but got rid of that fairly quickly. Anyway, if not having a two-button mouse is any kind of a deterrent for you, set that problem aside. Heck, I actually use a Microsoft mouse. It was the coolest wireless mouse out there with a nice feel to it. I love it. I just don't like their operating system. Oh, well, that's another story. Time for an update on my use of Parallels to run guest operating systems like Windows and Linux on my Mac. These guys at Parallels came out with two new updates in the 1 week since I last casted. They're now on what they call Beta 3. They're developing this so quickly, and I'm learning so much, and it's already so good that I haven't even done the boot camp thing yet. I can't think what functionality boot camp would give me that I don't already have in Parallels, just less convenient. For those of you who aren't familiar with Bootcamp, that's the new application that Apple came out with that allows you to dual boot your machine. You have to choose at the beginning, do you want to be in Windows or do you want to be on the Mac? I imagine the Windows installation probably runs a bit faster running native by itself instead of as a guest operating system within OS X. But man, having to reboot, that's a bummer. That's just no fun at all. So right now I'm running Windows XP along with CentOS, which is one of the Linux distributions. So here's what I've learned in using Parallels so far since I talked to you last. The most important thing I gotta emphasize as soon as you do this is pick a really big number for the size of the disk space that you allocate. It doesn't use all of that disk space when you give it to it. It's actually just the maximum size that it could ever take. So, for example, I used 4 gigabytes for the virtual machine when I started it, which is the default size. 4 gigs seemed like a big number. How big could Windows be? But after I loaded up a few applications and some virus protection and a couple of browsers, I was down to 160 megabytes of disk left. And here's the downside. That means you have to erase the disk, this installation, erase all of your applications and all of your Windows installation and start completely over. You cannot change this on the fly. You have to do it at the beginning. So when I started over, I gave it 12 gigabytes, and I think I'm going to be fine. Just to make sure I'm really clear about this, it doesn't use 12 gigabytes. Right now, I should explain. The Parallels installation puts two files on your disk. In this case, it's called winxp.hdd, which is for my 12 gigabyte installation with a lot of applications and browsers and virus protection, all that stuff running. It's only using up 2.69 gigabytes of my disk, but it could grow to 12 gigabytes if I let it. And there's another little tiny file called winxp.pvs, and it's just some sort of little associated file. The cool thing about those two files is you can burn those off to a DVD and take it over to another Macintosh running Parallels, and you can actually reenact your entire operating system just like you had it. Everything that you have in that OS will go with you. It's really, really cool. Of course, I don't know anybody else running it, but I got to test that sometime soon. So anyway, make sure you pick a big number for your disk space because I don't want you to have to do it twice like I did. The updates are improving it quite a bit. I think it self-figures out which network card you're using. I set it up for hardwired, but it went on to wireless on its own when I was disconnected. So I think it figures it out on its own, but I'm not sure. You no longer have to figure out which network adapter you're running. Remember last week I went into this elaborate explanation of how to figure out is EN0 your wired connection and EN1 is your wireless connection because they're using the Linux terminology? Well, now it just says wired and wireless next to EN0 and EN1. So that's a nice little update. You don't have to be near as much of a geek to figure it out. Remember, when you choose that, though, you can do that on the fly. Unlike the disk space, you can flip back and forth between the wired and wireless each time you launch the app, guest operating system. Unfortunately, you can't do it on the fly when the operating system is up, but at least you can flip it back and forth as you launch. You can also change your memory size as you launch. So if you're working along and you've got it set at 512 megs and you decide you want to give it some more, you can exit the guest operating system, change it, and go right back in with more memory. One of the nicest things they improved in the latest update is you can now put the MacBook Pro to sleep when it's running Windows. So it used to be if you closed your MacBook Pro or put your iMac to sleep, it would actually completely crash the operating system, all of them, any ones that you're running, and you'd have to reboot. But now it doesn't do that. But it's funny, it still crashes if I'm running CentOS, or if it's even ready to boot into CentOS. I don't even have to have CentOS up, and it'll crash. I got to let them know about that. They do have a wiki on their website over at Parallels, so you can put in wish list items or talk to them about problems. And they're pretty responsive. I've actually gotten some emails back from them already. Sound is sort of working now. I think it might be a little bit of user trouble, but I have run online some similar experiences that some sounds play just fine, like when Windows boots up, it makes the little happy Windows noises, and when it shuts down, it makes happy little shutdown noises. But some file things are jerky right at the beginning and then smooth out, and some just stay jerky. I tried playing my podcast through iTunes on Windows under Parallels, and it just never stopped being jerky. But they said they are working on this. One of the most important things that doesn't work so far is file transfers between OS X and any guest operating system. The Windows virtual machine, or Linux if that's what you're running, doesn't see the normal OS X drives, and the OS X side can't see into the guest OS, even if you have Windows set up to write to FAT32, which is readable by the Mac side, you can't actually see the disk. You also can't use a thumb drive to move files between the two because they haven't enabled USB support yet. I shouldn't say they completely don't have USB support. You can use a USB mouse, but you can't use a USB thumb drive to talk to the two. The wiki over at Parallels.com does say that USB support is coming in the next rev, and at the rate they're changing this, it'll be any minute now. In fact, as you're listening to this, it might be there by now. So don't worry. It'll be there soon. The one thing you could do, I think, is you could burn a CD on one side and read it over on the other side, because both sides can definitely see the CD drive. But that'd be a big waste of media unless you're moving a bunch of stuff, because the guest OS can't read a multi-session CD, so you couldn't even use a CDRW. You just burn CDs and then throw them away. Too much landfill. The final way I tried to move files was to map the drive of one as a network drive to the other. This doesn't work either. Both ways, doesn't work. Even though both OSs can mount network drives of other machines, and they have separate IP addresses, they somehow can't see each other. It's almost like when you tell it to look for the other IP, it starts to go out in the network and go out of the machine, but then it turns right around and it comes right back in without ever going outside of the machine. I wrote on the wish list section of the wiki that I'd like to see something like the shared folders option they have on VMware for the PC. I'm sure they'll get it going pretty soon. The one thing I guess you could do that would work now is to mount a network server as a network drive to both OSs and then drag and drop files to the server or even leave the files up there for both sides to access. One other thing that's a little bit hinky is Control-Alt-Delete. It turns out there's no delete key on the Mac keyboards. Even though the Macs have a key that says delete on it, it's actually backspace, and it doesn't send the correct delete signal to Windows. Parallels does include a pull-down menu where you can send the command, though. I also understand there's a way to do key mapping to make it happen, but I haven't tried that yet. My buddy Bernard found an interesting keystroke. He held down Function, Control, Option Command, that's the four buttons on the bottom left, and hit Delete, and it sent a Control Alt Delete signal. We tested it, did it four or five times, and it worked great. So we were all excited, and then it didn't work the next time I tried it, then it worked the next time, didn't work the next time, hard to tell. I have had a little trouble with the caps lock key. I don't quite know what's going on, but every once in a while, the Windows operating system just thinks I have the caps lock key on, and it starts typing in capital letters. This got really annoying when we were installing the operating system, and it was doing it while I was putting in the password. We actually had to start over once because I no longer had administrative privileges, because I couldn't figure out which letters were capital and which ones weren't, because of course I couldn't see the password. In order to get it to stop talking in caps, I have to turn the caps lock on. And then of course in the middle of that, it'll decide to flip back the other way and it says, why are you typing in capital letters? It's kind of annoying, but I'm sure that'll go away soon too. That's pretty much it for the excitement on Parallels right there. But I'm going to be running some benchmarks on MATLAB on CentOS this week, so that should be fun to hear how it's going. So remember the onMac.net guys who put out the reward for anyone who could run Windows and the Intel-based Macs? Those are the guys that gave us the hacked Windows that was so much fun. Boy, that was a great night. Even though these guys got kind of overridden by Apple's Boot Camp and Parallels Virtual Machine, they have not faded into the night. I really like the way these guys are adapting to the rapid changes. Instead of just fading into the night, they've adapted to become a valuable central point for all the cool activities that are going on. When you go to their website now, they act as a portal not only to their hack, which they now refer to as onMac.net XOM, but also Apple's Bootcamp and Parallels Workstation. They also have a section on Apple's hardware information for Intel Macs. They've taken the game up a notch by showing you how to triple boot via Bootcamp. They've figured out how to run Windows, OS X, and Linux as a triple boot. Again, not all at the same time, but one at a time. These guys know how to have fun, I'm telling you. In my geeky world, that's about as good as it gets. I'm really serious about how fun this all is. I've been deliriously happy for the last few weeks. This is a geek's heaven era. All of the old rules are gone. People are coming together to share. I know I'm waxing poetic here, but I really think the OS could just become irrelevant. We won't be tied to anything. Run Windows to play your games or at work if you have to run Microsoft Access. That's great. Run OS X when you want to do your multimedia applications like iMovie and iDVD. Run Linux as a server for the freedom. We can literally have it all now. I think the OS wars might be over and everybody won. You probably think I'm a lunatic, but I really think the playing field has shifted and it's just going to become more fun. Listener Michael, remember the fabulous illustrator I told you about last week at Majur.com? He sent in an interesting tip. He said, we all know that when a camera's compact flash or smart media card is inserted into a Mac, iPhoto or Aperture would start up to accept imports. If you want a flash drive to do this, you could create a folder on the top level named, in all caps, DCIM. Then inside that, create another folder entitled 100PVITT, again in all caps. Afterwards, dismount the flash drive, insert it again, and then iPhoto will start up and recognize it for photo imports. I tested this myself and it didn't launch iPhoto, but I'm pretty sure it's because I've disabled auto launch in image capture. I know I did that ages ago because I actually use iView Media Pro to manage my photos. Didn't launch iView Media Pro though either though, so I probably botched something up along the line. However, when I launched iPhoto and iView Media Pro, they both recognized that a camera was attached and offered to import. There was one funny part there though. iPhoto said no name was attached, which is the clever name I have on my thumb drive. But when I launched iView Media Pro, it said the thumb drive was called QA90. That was C-U with an accent A-90. I have no idea what that means. If someone knows what that means in some other language, send me an email. I'd really like to know. My online translators couldn't find anything, so I'm just going to assume that maybe it means thumb. This was an interesting tip, Michael, and I do appreciate your second email back to me explaining how I have botched up image capture in the auto launch, so I'm sure other people won't have that problem because they don't muck around as much as I do. I'm not quite sure how I'd use this, but it is an interesting tool to play around with and try to figure out how these things work. Well, I have a great tip on how to use a PowerBook as a heatsink. Unfortunately, my MacBook Pro continues to heat up to a ridiculous temperature. I actually hit 52 degrees Celsius today, That's 126 degree Fahrenheit. That was when I was running a firmware update. And that's really, really uncomfortable on your lap. I'm afraid I might have to send it back soon, or maybe I can get Apple to give me a new machine since I've already lost 1 week with it because of the CD burner issue. They also didn't fix two of the three problems I asked them to fix when I sent it back. We'll do a test on my negotiation skills there and see what I can pull off. I do have one solution when I'm working with it in my lap. Like I said, I'm using a closed PowerBook on my lap as a heatsink for the MacBook Pro. I just set the MacBook Pro on top of the PowerBook. As a heatsink, it dropped the MacBook Pro a couple of degrees, but the PowerBook was starting to get pretty hot on top. I just loaded that firmware update that some people claim fixed the problem. I'm dubious, though, because they said it seemed cooler. I'm more of an empirical person. I like facts and data and plots and graphs and that sort of thing. Since I'm running temperature monitor to measure the disk temperature, I'll know for sure whether it's fixed or not. By the way, temperature monitor is a freeware application from bresync.de. That's S-I-N-K.de. I'll keep you posted, but the temperature is already at 43 degrees C and rising even as I write this. The research department, Niraj, has been busy this week. He sent me a couple of items, and I'm going to push some of them out to next week because I have too much to talk about here today. But today's story from research department, Niraj, is about a speed test the folks over at final-cut-pro.de performed comparing four Mac models. They compared the Intel iMac, the MacBook Pro, the dual-core G5, and an iMac G5. They used the universal binaries of Final Cut Pro 5.1 for these tests. The G5 tower was a dual 2 GHz. The iMac G5 was a 2.1 GHz single core. The Intel iMac was a 2 GHz core duo, and the MacBook Pro was a 2 GHz core duo as well. All four machines had 1.5 GB of RAM and their appropriate graphics cards, all with 128 MB of video RAM. Here's the amazing thing. The two Intel Core Duo machines outperformed the two G5s by 3 or 4 to 1. The slowest was the iMac G5 at 232 seconds. The fastest was the iMac Core Duo at 53 seconds. This suggests that even a Mac Mini with a dual core chip in it could be a viable Final Cut Pro machine. That's simply amazing. If you can't get to this speed test over at finalcutpro.de, with dashes between each word, I never could get it to come up for some reason. Check out hardmac.com. They have a summary about halfway down their blog with some graphs that shows these speed tests. Last week, listener Lynn asked about CAD programs for the Mac that would help the user to create floor plans for remodeling and basic drawing libraries. Tim Verporten suggested a couple of different applications that Lynn is studying right now, and also my buddy Ron found us a couple of more. I definitely need to find time to play with these myself, but in the meantime, here's Ron's suggestions. QCAD from ribbonsoft.com is an application for computer-aided drafting in two dimensions. With QCAD, you can create technical drawings such as plans for buildings, interiors, or mechanical parts. QCAD works under Linux, Unix systems, Mac OS X, and Windows. The source code of the QCAD Community Edition is released under the GPL open source license. You gotta love that. That means free, baby. The marketing on their website pushes their intuitive interface. I need to download this one for sure. It doesn't look like it has the libraries for home elements that Lynn was looking for, but I'm always looking for a good drawing program to do scaled drawings. The other application Ron ran across is a shareware program called Cadintosh 5.3.2 from lemkesoft.de. That's lemkesoft.de. I like the name Cadintosh, that's for sure. Let's investigate what it can do. Cadintosh is a 2D CAD program for technical and architectural drawings. The shareware version has simple layer filter, easy to use, and internal symbols. Number of symbols is only limited by memory. The registered version has an additional extended layer filter, named filter sets, palettes with the name of the filters, and external symbol libraries. At this point, you're thinking that Lemke software sounds familiar, right? Well, they're the guys who wrote Graphic Converter, one of the most widely used shareware programs of all time. I couldn't resist wandering around the Lemke site, and I found out that Graphic Converter is now a universal binary. meaning it runs under the Intel and Power PCs as well. Well, thanks, Ron, for those suggestions. I'll definitely check both of those out. Hope those help you out too, Lynn. My associate Chad had an interesting problem. He exported a mailbox from Apple's mail program a while ago with 66 messages in it. He's decided he wanted to pull it back into mail, but Apple's import tool doesn't seem to recognize it. He couldn't figure out why. I did some hunting around and I discovered that it turns out Apple stopped using mboxes somewhere along the line because they couldn't have them be indexable by Spotlight for searching, since they were no longer separate files but one fat file. So they've switched over to using a format called EMLX. This means that you can't just pull them back in anymore. Seems counterintuitive, and maybe there's a real way to do it using the Apple tools, but Apple's keeping it hidden if it is out there, because I couldn't find it. The good news is I did find a freeware utility called EMLX to Mbox Converter from CosmicSoft.net. This will put them back into Mbox format for you. I tested this converter tool, and it definitely made my individual mail messages into one nice Mbox file. The funny thing is that mail still wouldn't recognize it if I told it I was importing from mail. I had to choose other as the mail client from which I was importing to get it to recognize it. This is a bit of an obscure problem that Chad had, but I wanted to write it up so that at least I would know where to find it later if I ever needed it. I use my podcast blog as a good research tool when I'm trying to remember, what was that tool? Put in a couple of keywords in the search window and I can find it on there. CosmicSoft also has an interesting product they sell called StarQuiz that allows you to create computerized quizzes and StarPlanet for creating lesson plans. I think both of these could be useful for teachers. My daughter is in her second year of college calculus now, brag, 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 and she was going to have to go to a separate lab to use the PCs that had MATLAB on them to complete her homework. She was awesome this quarter about selling her old school books online and buying used ones for this quarter. She did this totally of her own volition, no prompting on our part, even though we were the beneficiaries of the cost reduction. Because of all that savings, I decided to buy her own copy of MATLAB. The student pricing on the software is definitely a good marketing tool by the MathWorks people. They sell MATLAB and Simulink combined for only $100 in the student version. MATLAB for a commercial application is thousands of dollars by itself. So think about what happens now. Kids come out of college and go to the workforce and immediately demand MATLAB to do their jobs. Can't live without it, right? Anyway, we went to load MATLAB on her Macintosh, and it turns out that it runs under X11. She asked me a hard question. She said, what's X11? I'll be darned if I can actually explain what X11 is. I have to use goofy nonsense words like environment. And, you know, it's an environment that it runs in, and I hate it when people do that. So since it's clear I don't actually know what I'm talking about, I'll just say some stuff has to have X11 to run, and MATLAB is one of those applications. X11 doesn't come on the standard install, so I had to go over and get our Tiger disk to install it on her iBook. And this is where I got mad. I don't understand this. But in order to install X11, I had to do an archive and install of her OS. Why the heck did I have to do that? She's already got a fully functioning OS. There's nothing wrong with it. Didn't need it replaced. But the checkbox next to the standard system install stuff was grayed out, so I couldn't uncheck it. What a drag. So that meant when she got back to school, her printer didn't work. Had to dig out the printer driver CDs and reinstall that. I couldn't figure out where to find them in this previous system, but now, of course, that previous system is sitting over there sucking up a bunch of disk space, too. And she also had to run software update for nearly an hour to get her back to 10.4.6. Oh, well, she's up and running now, and she was able to get her entire lab done on MATLAB, and she got to teach me a little bit about how to run MATLAB. I'd actually never used it myself. I'm going to install MATLAB on CentOS under Parallels later next week, so now I have a clue to see how to start playing with it at least. Last week on the podcast, I read a letter from Jonathan of the Mac Tips Daily podcast, where he talked about another podcast creation tool called Podcast Maker. I told you how great I think Feeder is, and I'd feel disloyal to Steve Harris of Reinvented Software if I didn't use Feeder, because he's been just fabulous support for me, and the tool works really well. Well, Steve listened to the show, and he had a very interesting comeback to my comments. I think it will come across best if I use Steve's own words here, so let me just read you his letter. part of what he's talking about here is I had written to him asking about how to edit the GUID field by hand. So that's what he's talking about at the beginning. He says, while you're on the line, I noticed you mentioned Podcast Maker in the latest show. First of all, you probably couldn't make the above changes in Podcast Maker because it's not set up that way. But I need to say something about Podcast Maker here. It's brilliant. Unlike Feeder, it's completely dedicated to podcast creation and has some neat tricks. So there are some things you can do in Podcast Maker that you can't do in Feeder and vice versa. Podcast Maker might give you a little less control over things than Feeder, but as a result, it's easier to use. If you start off by using Podcast Maker, you won't go far wrong. Feeder accommodates the more awkward people who have things set up just so and want to keep it that way. I should also say that I met the Potion Factory developers at the Podcast Expo, and they became friends. Andy Kim and Jin Kim, who are based in LA, are exceptionally talented developers and ones to watch in the future. We are aware that we both have our niches, and I think it's working well for both of us. I'm a strong believer that lighting someone else's flame doesn't diminish your own, so there you have it. But keep using Feeder or I shall burn your house down. I'm impressed by Steve's attitude, and I'll probably check out PotionFactory.com's Podcast Maker, and I think I'll re-up my fire insurance while I'm at it. Well, it's time to wrap up the show. As always, your email comments and questions are very welcome. Shoot them on over to me at allison@podfeed.com. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.